My name is James Manyika, and on behalf of the World Affairs Council, I'll be your moderator this evening. It is my distinct pleasure to introduce tonight's guest. Dr. Matthew Burrows serves as the director of the Atlantic Council's Strategic Foresight Initiative and was the principal drafter of the National Intelligence Council's publication, Global Trends 2030, Alternative Worlds. He was appointed counselor to the National Intelligence Council in 2007 and director of the analysis and production staff in 2010. He has previously served as an analyst for the Directorate of Intelligence with the CIA, special assistant to the U.S. Ambassador to the UN, and as Deputy National Security Advisor to the U.S. Treasury Secretary. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Matthew Burrows for what should be a very interesting discussion and lively discussion on the future declassified mega trends that will undo the world unless we take action.
Well, thank you, James, and also thank you. I'd like to thank the World Affairs Council here for hosting me. I wanted to begin the presentation and talk a little bit about why I did the book, my background, and then get into some of the key issues of what I fear about the future, but also, very importantly, what I'm looking forward to about the future. So I, as James alluded to, I retired last year from the National Intelligence Council. I was a lifetime CIA analyst. Part of that, part of your career, you spend a lot of time outside, actually, the Directorate of Intelligence. And so the last 10 years, I actually worked at the National Intelligence Council, and that council reports to the Director of National Intelligence. It has a very special role, and that role is to take all the intelligence generated by all the 16 intelligence agencies throughout the U.S. government, try to make sense of it in terms of what this, what sort of implications, what sort of impacts the intelligence reports we're getting has on the president's key foreign policy priorities. And the National Intelligence Council, called the NIC, actually does what's called estimative intelligence. So this is looking out 3 to 5 years usually on what are going to be the future of Iraq or Afghanistan. What sort of, you're making judgments because obviously you don't have all the knowledge you need to predict where it's going to go. Oftentimes you are talking about scenarios. And every 4 years, the NIC also produces global trends. So this is a work looking out farther, 15, 20 years. It's usually called Global Trends, the last one, Global Trends 2030. That was produced in 2012. And this it goes back to actually to the mid-90s. Now, the reason for doing the publication every 4 years and also publishing it just at the beginning of the administration is that's the time when most administrations are looking out farther than they do during the course of their administration where they get really caught up in crises. It's also the time that a lot of the different departments of government, like the Pentagon, the State Department, the Department of Homeland Security, begin to look at their strategies. What do they need to do to deal with some of these long-term trends? So that's the reason we did it. The other reason that we also, the NIC has done it for all these years, is it was a way of bringing in expertise from outside to really educate the intelligence community. It was begun in the mid-1990s after the end of the Cold War. So a lot of people on the NIC, and NIC is very special in government in that there are a lot of people from outside the intelligence community that are appointed to the NIC. About a third to two-thirds actually are from the outside. The chairman is usually a non-careerist who comes on, and they saw that the intelligence community wasn't looking at some of the key factors. So global trends, I was the principal author on the last three of these works. And in the course of doing this, I spent a huge amount of time getting outside of Washington. I had the chairman who appointed me said, if you're going to do this stuff, you need to get outside the Beltway. So that's what I did, went outside in the rest of the country, talked with a lot of experts, but also went overseas. And so by the end, when I was doing the last edition, visited about 20 countries. A lot of those countries actually use global trends. They translate it, use it for their own strategic planning purposes. And in talking throughout U.S., I really was seized by the fact that, you know, a lot of Americans were very puzzled and concerned about what was happening in the future. And this actually increased every time I did it. I noticed a lot more worry. And what it disturbed me in some sense, I remember going to Penn State, being in a class of, these are all graduate engineers, very good prospects for jobs. And yet they were all, you know, talking about worst-case scenarios. When I tried to get them to vote on, you know, where they saw the world going, they all picked the worst case. And I could barely get them to think about even a moderate case of kind of muddling through, which probably the most likely and usually is in most of these scenarios. But, you know, I worried that first that we weren't as a nation thinking about these broad trends, that we had a huge stake, certainly in what the world was going to be like. We were also at this pivotal point where you can see that there's huge changes, and I would say most of them are good, but nevertheless, you know, these are really historically unprecedented changes that are happening. I talked in the book about, you know, this period that we're in is like after the First World War, when you had the Versailles, after 1815 in Europe, when you had the Congress of Vienna, pivotal moments when you're really reshaping the world. Now, we haven't had a major war like the First World War or the Napoleonic Wars. These things are happening when, you know, we're not necessarily all sitting down the world and thinking through these problems and figuring out exactly what we should do to avoid the worst scenarios. But, you know, for the U.S., we got lots here at stake. We were the ones that designed the world after 1945. We should also be thinking very strategically about where we want to take the world in the future. Now, as I mentioned, there are a lot of very good things happening. And that's what first I wanted to stress. And certainly the book starts with a chapter called The Power of One. And this is really about this great growth of the global middle class. So we're seeing, you know, in a very short amount of time, you're talking 30, 40 years, this huge rise of middle classes, a lot of them in Asia, but actually also all around the world. You're talking about hundreds of millions. You know, some of the predictions for 2030 are 1 billion to 3 billion people joining the middle class. This completely changes, you know, the history that we have known. I mean, we know that the world, most everybody in the world was poor, and that was the condition, you know, for everything until the present. We also have, you know, aging, which, you know, there's some disturbing aspects of it, particularly when you're talking about can we maintain economic growth. But we're also, this is a wonderful development. I mean, in the sense, living longer, but also living much better quality lives. and we have a lot to look forward to. If you're looking at all the technological changes, and obviously it's quite a bit in the book about the coming technological revolutions, a lot of it is very good news. But that's a feature, you know, again, we haven't had societies where medium age is 50 or above. And when you're, you know, large numbers are living into their 80s and even into their 90s. So again, something that, you know, does have some negative. And in fact, I would say on all of these trends we're talking about, they're dual-edged. When you're thinking about this, you know, individual empowerment, which is the concept I developed to describe what is happening in terms of rise of global middle class, empowerment of minorities, women, the spectacular education gains that we're seeing, the spectacular health gains that we're seeing. You're also seeing the fact that small groups, individuals, can do enormous amount of harm. You know, they can do the sort of harm that was formerly the monopoly of states. And for the intelligence community particularly, this is a huge concern. And if you notice, if you follow, there's a document that the intelligence community produces again through the NIC every year called the Annual Threat Assessment. And every year we talk more and more about lone wolves or very small groups, splinter groups of Al-Qaeda. So here are groups that, you know, they're want to do harm. They want to do as much disruption as possible. Very little way of dissuading them. And even when you are taking them out, you know, they're using that as a propaganda. They're demonstrating how they're martyrs, how the Westerners are repeating the Crusades. That's a huge, you know, problem, actually. And when you're looking at technologies like biotech and when you're looking at cyber, you can imagine in the future that you could have cyber terrorists who are less focused on bringing down big buildings, much more focused on taking apart institutions. You know, that's not beyond the realm of possibilities. Same way with biotech, you know, inventing, putting together a very lethal virus for the purposes of real destruction. So that is something that we will have to live with. Hopefully we'll have ways of managing that. But that's one of the more difficult trends to think about. Now, one of the things that when you're doing the trends work, and one of the things that we discovered as we did the trends more and more, was that actually there's a lot happened that, you know, you can't predict just through trends. And this gets into why you do scenarios, because increasingly you see shocks, surprises, those, you know, single events actually having a dynamic of their own. And when you think of, you know, would we have invaded Iraq if you didn't have 9/11? I mean, and that's now, we were within the NIC debating this, you know, should we change our name? I mean, this is, you know, a brand name by the time I started working on it, Global Trends, but increasingly, if you look at the amount of space that's devoted actually to the shocks and surprises and working out the scenarios, it was increasing a much larger portion of the work. And for policymakers, I mean, this again is a difficult issue that, you know, yes, you have, you know, these great trends, you have some that you have to watch out for, but you do have these shocks and surprises that can come at you, have much more impact than people realize. And yet you have to think about, you know, how you deal with it. And you don't have the luxury of not reacting to them. So that's the purpose, and also the purpose in the book, of thinking about, you know, what are the possibilities of scenarios? And they are pretty wide. And this gets back to the idea of you're at a pivotal moment, is that you can see some pretty dark scenarios ahead, particularly if you get lots of conflict. You know, there is a good trend here. Historically, we're at a very low point, including on civil discord, even though we see in a lot of the newspapers about what all the things that are happening in the Middle East, we're nevertheless at a very low ebb historically in terms of numbers and numbers of people being killed in conflict. Nevertheless, those conflicts, once they get started, on average go 6 to 9 years. This is how you can get really depressed about the Middle East, because they aren't going to be easily stopped. And even when they're stopped, there's a 40% chance of an outbreak. Again, so with conflict, I think, you know, this, if there's something that keeps me up, it is the fact that once you get into a conflict, and I worry especially on the Middle East, just not with the ISIS stuff, but also with the Sunni-Shia rivalry, that you actually could get yourself in a very bad world, and one that it would be hard actually for powers like the U.S., others on the outside to stop. It gets to be of such magnitude. One of the, you know, the book is written, there's a last section on scenarios. They're written as fictional stories because I wanted actually people to approach these like you would a narrative, to really see how things could happen. You have two very good ones, and I would say two pretty bad ones. One of them is focused on the Middle East, where you end up in a nuclear exchange, pitting Saudi and Israel against Iran. You know, that is not inconceivable, and that sort of world then has huge implications for the rest of us in terms of our growth potential. Similarly, if you can, you know, what I saw as game changers, if you could have a reconciliation, a real trusted relationship between U.S. and China, I think that would be a game changer actually for very positive future. You know, these are the two major powers. Finally, I just, you know, what probably the other big worry that I had, and obviously a huge reason for doing this, is on the U.S. itself and the U.S. Governance system. As I said, I think the U.S. is very highly capable of managing, navigating the shoals here in this world, the only power actually that can really do it. When you stack up strengths and weaknesses, the U.S. comes very much out on top. But if you don't have a governing system that really allows you to take the steps you need, then what purpose is the strength? And that, I think, is, you know, a worry. And it's, you know, a worry in an intelligence report you actually can't put in that, because you're not supposed to be talking about the U.S. Although, you know, we had a chapter in the last Global Trends talking about the U.S. as a game changer. It was to say that the rest of the world really regarded the U.S. as a risk factor. And that was a huge change from 10 years ago. But this is, we've got to somehow deal with the political logjam at the federal level. Much better what's going on at the local level, really dealing practically with these questions. If that isn't settled, then I think, you know, our chances in this future world, our chances to really shape that world, are much slimmer. And that would be the other thing besides, you know, all these bad actors, terrorists, or conflicts, whatever, that really keeps me up at night. On the other hand, I do know, and I leave on a much more optimistic level, that, you know, we do have all those capabilities, particularly in the American public itself. And I think, you know, that's the source of our real regeneration, that we have, you know, highly capable, highly educated new generation, in fact, that's coming up. You see this, you know, in the institution I'm in at the moment, the Atlantic Council, all the interns are probably better qualified than most of us who are the staff in terms of the number of languages and so on, and their understanding, too, of the world. If we can pull, and we also we're still this magnet for the world's talent. Everybody wants to come to the U.S. And if we can use those sources to really change what I think is something that needs to be changed, but once it is changed, once we find that solution, then we can really unlock America that really finds a new role and also shapes the world, not just for its own interests, which was the case after 1945. It wasn't just we shaped the world, obviously helped us enormously, but it also brought about what we see today, which is the rise of other powers. If we can shape the world again that way, then we all have a really bright future ahead of us. So on that optimistic note, I'll turn it back to the moderator, and we can also begin to get into a discussion and really talk about these issues.
Thank you very much, Matt, for your opening remarks. I think a good place to start is, I mean, I know that as part of this work you did for Global 2030, as well as even the research for the book, you looked at a vast number of trends specifically. Could you at least list some of the ones that stood out for you as being some of the most important ones to pay attention to?
Well, obviously the growth of the global middle class. There's a, you know, not so nice trend there that the Western middle classes haven't done as well. So real worry there about, you know, where we can get our traction again. Urbanization, which obviously McKinsey Global Institute, and I should say here that, you know, one of the best sources actually for understanding global trends is the work that the McKinsey Institute, Global Institute does. And certainly on urbanization, I mean, I think you've been out front and talking really about how cities are going to be generating the real wealth in the future. How they're growing spectacularly, and these are really secondary cities in not just China, but also Africa. Obviously, another series of trends I didn't mention in the opening is the resource. So ones like water, food, energy, real worries on water, particularly in, the developing countries, particularly in Africa, but in other, you know, China, India have severe water problems. I think they have more means to deal with it. What I really worried about were countries like in Africa that didn't have those means of dealing with what is going to be a severe problem. Certainly, you know, the demographic picture, which as you're doing any of these future studies, you spend a lot of time looking at the demography because it's one of these certainties, I mean, over a 15, 20-year period. So you have a diversity of things that are happening. You have the aging, which I talked about, which is really new. But you also have, you know, these continuing Youth bulges in a smaller number of countries, but nevertheless still there. And some worry, increased worry actually since doing the Global Trends 2030, that the world's population is going to continue to grow and not to plateau. And this has, again, this is over a longer time period than just 15, 20 years, but that has severe implications really on the resource issues. So those were some of them. Then technology was something that we felt we had ignored in the earlier editions, so we spent quite a bit of time looking at some of the new manufacturing technologies, 3D printing, robotics, really how that changes the workplace, obviously worries about employment since, robotics particularly displacing a lot of workers, both highly skilled and low-skilled workers. So how is this going to work out both in developing and developing countries? And then, as I mentioned, again, conflict, which, is a good picture, actually, if you're looking historically, in the last 30, 40 years, you haven't had a major interstate conflict since the Second World War. You've had kind of very much an uptick after the end of the Cold War in terms of civil conflicts, Yugoslav and so on, but that had leveled off. There's recently another uptick, which of course is in the Middle East. So those were, we put in the last global trends, as well as I spent a lot of time in the book on this, that we really see the risk on both major interstate conflict and civil wars and civil conflict actually going up. And that would be, as I mentioned before, a real disaster. And then the final one is the inclusion of U.S. I mean, we thought of it as a constant. When global trends began in the 90s, it was clear when I was going out and talking to a lot of others that U.S. was not necessarily seen in a negative light, but not in a positive light in sense of consistency, where it was going to be, what was its engagement, their whole, and again, McKenzie's done some wonderful work on looking at U.S. energy self-sufficiency, but there's a good and bad consequence. I mean, it could lead to U.S. not being interested as much in the outside, particularly in the Middle East, because it really doesn't rely or doesn't have to rely now on imported oil. I don't think that's going to quite happen in the extreme case, but you have seen in the opinion polls really a trend line going down of feeling that we were overexposed, carrying this burden when others should have been. And that is a disconcerting to a lot of people overseas who really want more of the U.S., surprisingly.
Well, there's actually quite a lot to chew on there. Several of the questions that have come through are asking relate to the first batch of trends you just described, which have a lot to do with scarcity of water, mm-hmm. natural resources, food, even linked to population growth. Talk a little bit about the ramifications of that, of those kinds of scarcity-oriented trends.
Well, I think we're already seeing some of that. I mean, you can look at Darfur really as a resource conflict where the factors, of this continuing drought in the Sahel region as really playing a direct role in civil conflict. You can also even look at Syria, because they also experience several years of fairly severe drought. Those are the direct impact. I think when you're, I
relate in the book, I was in West Africa and Nigeria, real worry there about split up of Nigeria, because northern part of Nigeria having to really deal with this influx migrants, in part because of the continuing droughts in Sahel, not being able to manage, it's a poorer part of the country anyway. And growing conflict there that is in part fed. I think the way you look at this is that it is another factor of instability. It doesn't necessarily mean that there will be instability and that some countries will be able to cope. But an increasing number, and I think particularly Africa, you have a number of countries there who won't be able to cope. And unfortunately, those are the ones that are most severely impacted by rising temperatures. So, I mean, this in terms of agriculture production, that's going to weigh very heavily. And also changing precipitation patterns, which also can be harmful, since you have a lot of seed varieties that can't deal with the different with those changes. The issue here for the U.S. is really that after 9/11, and the intelligence community was very important in this, is that we made the case that, look, these resource issues, this climate change impacts, is really a national security interest. Because if these countries fail, then we can have the ramifications of greater instability, more terrorism groups, whole list of instability issues that could affect the U.S. I think there's a feeling anyway when you talk to people in Washington that they're drawing back from that, that, you know, is this really a national interest? And that's part of that disengagement. So I think it's very important to keep these issues right front and center. And as a moral issue, you know, do we want one continent to be mired in a downward spiral while the rest of us in many ways growing much more prosperous?
Several questions that touch on the role that technology plays in all of this, ranging from, so to what extent is technology a help or a problem? To what role can technology play in terms of either helping us predict some of these trends and understand them better and how they're playing out? And also, how do you think about even the role of whether it's social media or social networking as part of helping some of the decision-making process? So there's a set of questions about how do we think about the place that technology plays in as we try and understand the future for the next 20, 30 years?
Well, it's a little bit like, you know, technology is a little bit like these trends. I mean, they have, I would say, probably more positive than negative, but nevertheless, I mean, you have, you know, a spread of different impacts. I think on the social media, obviously, understanding what is happening in social media could have, I think, helped the intelligence community, the administration, understand earlier the Arab Spring, because we saw how, you know, that was a vehicle actually for the organizers to get people out on the street. I mean, that really showed just how much discontent there was. So it's a valuable indicator that way. It is, I think we have to be, you know, there's a lot of noise there too, and that I think is the issue of, you know, how do you interpret some of this, how do you mobilize this and get it to the analysts, and that's a big logistic problem in some ways, and there's a lot of work being done on that. I mean, because you got tons and tons, so no analyst can sit there and go through all of this alone. I mean, there has to be ways of picking out certain signals, and obviously that has to be done through computer programs and automation and so on, and that some of that were, you know, still being developed. But I think the key thing is, how do you put it together? How do you know when the discontent is going to turn into a revolution? And we haven't really solved that. I'm not sure we will ever completely resolve it. I think technology, you know, obviously it can solve all these water issues. The problem is cost in many cases, and the countries that it needs to be deployed to don't have the means. They don't have the education or training sometimes to use it. And that's actually something that, you know, I think some of the firms in Silicon Valley now are seized with, certainly some of the people who work you know, in the technology are really seized with the how do you apply that. I mean, we had a very good conference at the Atlantic Council not too long ago where we were really looking at how do you get the capital and so on to these firms who are trying to apply these various technologies to problems out in the developing world. And that's, I think, going to be a challenge. But hopefully that's something that we can do, and I think that's a reason actually to talk about the different scenarios that could happen.
There's been a lot of significant unrest in the world lately, everything from ISIS and Israel and Hamas and all the other things that are going on in the world, including outbreak of diseases and pandemics, Ebola and so forth. Were any of these sorts of crises or events predicted in past Global Trends report? And there's a related question also about to what extent can we really predict these things as opposed to maybe look only to the more long-term trends like demography, where you can have a reasonable amount of be able to predict them to some extent. So talk a little bit about how we, you know, how we might have been able to predict some of the things that we see going on now versus this kind of.
Well, I would say what we're seeing with ISIS, totally predictable, and I think we did a pretty good job of understanding just how one thing, you know, the fragmentation of Al-Qaeda is actually in some ways a much more dangerous development, because you're having to follow a lot more different, very smaller groups. But the other big thing was very clear that, you know, on Iraq, once we got out, that the Shia Sunni tensions were exploding. I mean, lots and lots of warnings on that. You know, this opened up a vacuum for ISIS really to exploit. So if you're looking at, you know, what is probably predictable and, you know, I think we have a very good track record of doing that. I mean, unfortunately, the worst case scenario that we always laid out about the Middle East is now the one that's happening. I think you're right in talking about that, you know, you're not predicting so much as you're showing that there is these different scenarios, and what you're hoping to do in a document like Global Trends is actually getting people to think about how you steer in a more positive direction. Because you cannot predict how it's going to turn out, because policymakers may take measures to ensure it doesn't go that direction. And that's the purpose of this document. I think if you're talking about a much harder situation to predict, I would say the annexation of Crimea, even though, you know, there are lots of analysis that had that as a possibility, and we knew that, you know, Moscow always considered that, you know, and not in the right hands, but there was a whole series of events there. Beginning with the EU offering a trade agreement that suddenly, and nobody really suspected this, that Putin would consider as a threat, because he hadn't up until that time taken much interest in the EU. And, you know, you have all of Central Europe, Eastern Europe, having some partnerships, whatever, suddenly he feels threatened. Then, you know, you have the Maidan, which is this uprising, I mean, that is predictable in the sense of what we talk about, individual empowerment, the power of one. I mean, that is but again, it's very hard to predict when and how it's going to play out. And so, and that series of events, and I think that is probably a little bit more difficult. But nevertheless, through scenarios you can develop, through gaming exercises, you can begin to get some idea of what could happen.
You talk quite a bit about, at the beginning in your opening remarks, about the role that the U.S. could play as a shaper. Could you also talk a little bit about the role in all of this that other major countries that have a lot at stake could play in this? So China, talk a little bit about that. Russia, you've touched on it, but also India and also Brazil. And also, if you could comment on how the different governance arrangements in those countries could even also affect how this plays out. Some of those are democracies, some of those are not.
Yeah. You know, there's kind of a peculiarity about the rise of China, India, less so on Brazil. I mean, these are huge countries now. We know that China, is going to surpass the U.S. in terms of its overall GDP, particularly if you're doing measured in purchasing power parity. And yet, unlike the U.S. when we rose in the 19th century or Germany, per capita income is still very low. And I don't think we have really, internalized this, but if you're in China and you talk about, well, you're this great power, you're getting most of your oil from the Middle East. In fact, Middle East is sending increasing, not the majority of its oil to Asia. Shouldn't you be taking some part here? And we've had this dialogue. I mean, Zelik talked about the responsible stakeholder. I mean, this is a very old dialogue we've had, and anybody who's talked to the Chinese about this will instantly be told, well, look, we're still a very poor country. And in the eyes of a lot of Chinese, I mean, they are still trying to get back, to where at least, McKenzie has this wonderful graphic about the center of gravity, and where it was two or three centuries ago was China was still the largest economic power, and in per capita sense also very rich. And so I think, if you're talking about who's going to shape the world, who's going to take responsibility for some of these increasing global challenges, whether the resources or the conflict and so on. Unfortunately, a lot of it is going to end up on U.S. shoulders, I fear. China, I think, wants to dominate its region, and I don't think it's been doing a very good job of doing that. I think it's causing a lot more problems for itself, but nevertheless, I think it has a very regional look. It doesn't, they tell you, look, Middle East is the graveyard of empires, we're not going to get into it, and I really think they mean it. So that is that's the real challenge for the U.S. How do you get burden sharing? We're seeing problem now of trying to get Arab states really to take first military, but I would say more importantly would be the issue of an economic role in rebuilding Iraq, Syria, these places, and it's hard going. And so that, I think if the U.S. doesn't actually lead, I think then scenarios you're talking about are different levels of chaos.
Well, say more about that. There's a lot of interest in what exactly could the U.S. do. So you talked about it in one sense as being a risk factor at the beginning of your remarks, and you also mentioned in several of your points about the United States providing leadership. To what extent is the risk us as opposed to what's out there? Talk a little bit about either gridlock here at home, the ability to make decisions and those sorts of constraints. How much is the risk us versus these trends?
I would say that, you know, there's risk on both sides. I mean, you can't, you know, you're in this really turbulent period, huge amounts of change at all different levels coming at you in different ways. So you are going to have, I think, risk. I mean, there's always risk connected with change. So you're going to have higher levels of risk. I think you can, you send that risk up quite a bit if the U.S. isn't engaged. I think the other thing is that, you know, some of this is even a perception. I mean, and, you know, I would argue U.S. had to be more aggressive against Putin. Doesn't necessarily mean in terms of military measures, but in terms of really leading a charge maybe early on with much more powerful sanctions to send a very early on a message to Putin about, you know, what the costs were instead of slowly cranking it up. And that is the, you know, I think that's where the U.S. has got to be thinking that potential here for disorder has gone up. It's not clear necessarily about the partnerships. You know, developing those partnerships, I think that still is a major, should be a major priority. I think we have an opportunity here with TTIP and TPP, actually, to, on the trade side and on the economic, international economic side, actually, to shape future global economy. Those sort of measures we should be, you know, really taking up, and also, I think, educating the American public about. I mean, there needs to be a discussion about the necessary role at the same time that there is a lot of things that we have to do at home.
And in thinking about some of the things we have to do at home, one of the things is how we even gather information or drive initiatives that get us smart and smarter about many of these trends. The intelligence community is managing several initiatives, the Joint Information Environment, NGA's Map of the World. There are all these different initiatives. How much collaboration actually occurs between the different parts of the U.S. government or the U.S., the different entities within the U.S., maybe even including the private sector, that could play a role in informing or what we understand about some of these trends and what we might do about them? Could you talk a little bit about that?
I think there's more cooperation than there was, certainly within the intelligence community, and I mean the NIC's job, in fact, is to coordinate, bring together the 16. Where, and this goes beyond the intelligence community, I mean, where I don't think government has done a very good job is the public-private partnership. This is showing up, I think, and it's a huge question when you're looking at, like, tracking organized crime, cyber. I mean, this is where the private sector has as much at stake or more in a sense, but the information that you're gathering within the intelligence community is often not shared or not shared as quickly or as fully, and you get, you know, I've gotten huge, lots of people have come at me, I mean, complaints really in the business community about the need for much more info sharing. And I think that, you know, that's one sort of public-private partnership that really hasn't developed as fast, and even though that's been a stated aim ever since 9/11. But that is, I think there's probably more problems there than there is intra-government now. There's always, you know, going to be those tensions and the bureaucratic infighting, and you can read a lot about that in the Washington Post every day. But I actually think the bigger issue is this public-private partnership, and now how do you share this information that you have in government with people who are actually, you know, controlling the infrastructure, and where our national interests are being run, managed by the private sector.
And to what extent are we really in uncharted territory when we look out to all these trends? So, for example, are there any lessons from history that we can learn from? Are there any best practices in other countries? Are there examples of leaders that have taken, you know, bold steps against things like this? Are there fledglings of examples of where you see that bright spots, either in things that the U.S. is doing or others are doing? So, or are we truly in uncharted territory?
Well, it's clear. I mean, you know, as I talked, I mean, you do have some things that have never happened before. And so I think, you know, we are in some uncharted territory. But I still think, you know, I was trained as a historian. I think you can still draw some lessons, and there are some other examples on, you know, in terms of who does strategic foresight, and really getting that into the decision making. You know, Singapore is the example there. I mean, they've been doing it for now decades. They know how to pull it into the decision-making process, so have a longer-term perspective, can make those longer-term investments. We haven't been able to really master that yet, partly because much bigger government, you know, global power in a way that Singapore obviously isn't. So that would be one example. I think, you know, the lesson you learn perhaps in looking at history is how much leadership makes a difference. I mean, I once wrote in one of these global trends, I mean, if you look back on the 20th century, could you at all talk about the 20th century without talking about Stalin or Hitler or FDR? I mean, these are people that really brought a lot to the table, and how they you know, dealt with whatever was challenges in both ill or good, really shaped the future. So, you know, that would be one lesson, is how important leadership is. I mean, that trends, yes, are sometimes limiting factors, but nevertheless, you know, leaders have shown that they can shape those trends. So I think those are the sort of examples, you know, that are out there that you pull from, at the same time that you recognize that you are in a very much a different world. And I think, you know, for the U.S., it is, you know, even though we should celebrate it, this is a world that came about in many ways because of the system we put in place after 1945. And it is a great achievement, all these countries rising, global middle class, and so on. But we have to recognize that we can't act the same way, that the kind of partnerships that we relied on, I mean, we have to keep them, but we have to get new partners as well. And we face also, you know, some, you know, our values are not necessarily going to be the values in the future. I remember after the first global trends I did, we had a discussion at a very senior level in the White House. And there was on a PowerPoint that I put together as who integrates whom. And the White House senior official said, well, it's obvious. I mean, it's just enlarged West. I mean, it's just like what happened with Japan, Taiwan, Korea. I mean, those are essentially, you know, they're not geographically Western, but essentially part of the West. Or, you know, I would make the argument, no, we are going to have to find ways also of dealing with others who won't necessarily share all our values, and, you know, have done very well by not following, for example, the Washington consensus that we all said they should do in their rise. And so that's a different world, I think, and a much harder world in some ways.
Several people have pointed out that you didn't or barely mentioned at all climate change as a trend. Given the events of this week and also what's going on elsewhere, how big a deal is this? It seems to have disappeared from the public discourse for the most part, except when things like this week happen. But can you talk a little bit about climate change?
Yeah, I didn't mean to ignore it. I mean, I think it's a huge deal. The way I would see it again is one of these factors. I mean, I think I talked with the resource on the resource issues of really engendering a lot more instability. And my fear is that, you know, we may be past this tipping point, and that, you know, anything we do now is not going to actually change the trajectory that we're on. That makes it harder sometimes to make the case that we should be doing what we cutting down on carbon, which we should have been doing for some time ago. But and we have to now learn how to adapt, which is a very, when you're looking at this, we had a meeting in Washington this week on this. You're looking at this even for the U.S. I mean, it's a matter of huge flooding, the kind of forest fires we're seeing here in the West being endemic. I mean, and the water shortages, obviously. The kind of extreme weather that everybody thought would come, but much later, has actually come much earlier. And it is, you know, you can get very depressed by it, but because we had enough warning. And even if you didn't believe, or, you know, even if the science wasn't completely convincing or persuasive, there was enough there, I think, that there was enough risk that we should have taken measures earlier. You know, this is a problem, I think, particularly on this subject, because the impacts, at least, you know, some years ago, the impacts were seen as so far off that why should we be doing anything? And if we do take measures, it could undermine our growth, which for most people is the most immediate concern.
You've talked quite a bit about the role that individual countries, the U.S., China, and so forth, can play. Can you talk about how you see the role that, you know, going to the very large here, that multilateral institutions, maybe the U.N., could play in all of this? Or even aggregations of nations like the European Union, for example, could play in all of this. And then go to the other end of the spectrum, if you could, and talk maybe about what individuals might do at the other end of the spectrum.
Well, on the institutions, I mean, I think we're not, as a society now, we're not very big on the UN, and certainly a lot of people don't like Americans don't like the whole idea of the European Union, because it, you know, countries appear to be transferring their sovereignty, and of course that kind of goes against what most Americans think, you know, nations should be doing. But I think you can point to Europeans as probably, European Union took a very courageous stand, I think, on climate change. They're weakening a little bit, but I mean, they're the region, the institution actually that raised the issue and saw it at Copenhagen anyways to get a much more ambitious program underway. We're not successful on their diplomacy. The UN, I think, you know, they've also shown some leadership on, you know, getting the millennial development goals together, focusing attention on it. Obviously, you know, you can make the case that, you know, really China did the bulk of this in terms of pulling up, you know, that's where you see the most progress in terms of pulling up people out of poverty. But, you know, I think UN needs to be congratulated on those, that effort in actually setting some agendas out there and setting some goals. And, you know, it is the place where you go if you want to get authorization for conflict. My worry, and you know, I put it in the book, put it in the report, is that these institutions aren't reforming. I mean, they're not taking into consideration you do have this much expanded world of powers who've come of age, so to speak, and you know, they're, how are you going to tell a younger generation of Brazilians or Indians in 2030 that, look, you're, I don't know, what it is, an eighth of the world's population or whatever in India's case, and you don't raid a seat on the security, a permanent seat on the Security Council. I mean, those, your legitimacy is not going to hold, I don't think. It is at the moment, it's remarkable in many ways. I think it's largely, too, because of prestige. I mean, getting on is still seen as is this goal of kind of, it shows you've arrived. I mean, if you're there, even have the two-year seat. But how long is that going to last? And we're not doing really that kind of discussion about how you reform the institutions. You've had more on the economic side, but you have Congress now really holding up the reweighting, which is a small reweighting, really, of the voting scheme within the IMF. And I think you're going to lose those institutions if you don't find a way of changing and reforming them.
If you
and
could,
on individuals, you know, that's the first chapter. I think where it's a great age for individuals. Actually, I think you can have a huge impact through, you know, part of it's technology, it's social media, but the other part is, you know, through civil society, NGOs, and others. I mean, are really tackling a lot of the problems that states should be doing. So I think it's a great age actually for individuals.
Maybe that's actually a good note to end with the last question, which is, if you step back from all of this, what are some of the trends that you're most excited about and most optimistic about if you think about the well-being of, you know, humanity and poverty reduction and those kinds of issues? And how can we make sure that those more optimistic outcomes actually do happen?
Well, the one thing that makes me very optimistic is, and I, again, it's in that first chapter in the book, but if you compare, you know, the rates of education in the 19th century, when it was the Western world that was developing and industrializing, with the rates of the expansion of education in this new century, in the last couple decades of the last century, you'll find that actually it is spreading a lot faster. You're finding, you know, even in the developing world at the tertiary level, you know, more women than men. We all already have seen it actually, you know, in the developed world. And a lot of that is, too, when you look at the, you know, the surveys about, with this global middle class, well, what do you want? I mean, you know, the big business firms concentrate on, well, you're going to have people buying cars and houses and all this other. But a lot of the opinion polls actually say, well, you know, now I can save for the education of my children. And if somebody was, you know, actually in the city saying, you know, it's great. If you look at the Times of India, the first four pages are all these advertisements about colleges and tutors and where you can go to get prepared for university. First four pages of the New York Times, the ads are, you know, Cartier or Saks Fifth Avenue or whatever. I mean, all luxury goods. But, you know, you can tell, you know, where the really ambitions are of a society. I mean, you know, for the New York Times reader, apparently it is to get a new watch or something from Rolex. But for the Indian middle class, who are the ones buying the Times of India, it is education. And I think, you know, for me, that's one thing I really, individual empowerment starts there. And it's wonderful to see that, you know, that's where people really are investing huge resources. I mean, you look at, I think McKenzie did a report on how the Koreans actually shouldn't be investing as much as they are in preparing their children for university. And I forget how, what it was, like 40%.
40% more.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's incredible high. And there probably are. And Singapore, I remember going there, and, you know, the big argument last year was parents should be easing off on, you know, requiring their children to do all this homework. And this is a prime minister talking about this. And, you know, would you have had that conversation here? I mean, you should probably have the opposite, but given some of the our scores lately. But, I mean, that you know, is really uplifting, that really is the result of this growth in this global middle class. And obviously there some of their ambitions are going to be frustrated. This isn't going to be necessarily an easy path, but I think if you do get the education, and it's fabulous that, you know, women are leading the charge in a lot of these societies for that, then I think you're much better equipped to deal with all the challenges.
Well, on that optimistic note, Matthew, I just want to thank you for an excellent discussion and for all your remarks, and thank your audience for your terrific questions. As a reminder, Matthew's latest book, which is The Future Declassified, is actually available for sale today, and you'd be pleased to sign copies if any of you purchase copies. Again, thank you very much, and have a good evening.